Hi, Grace.
Hey, Quinn.
Ooh. Tina, they did you so wrong. Tina Cohen Chang. Okay, I'm actually like dead inside, but it's fine. How are you today?
Same.
I actually like I'm vibing. It's not been like the worst day. I don't know. French is a vibe, math is not. You are the vice versa, except you don't have math, you have English this time. Yeah. Did you get your report card?
I did.
Is
I
it
did.
good?
Yes, I think. But anxiety
okay. Did
tells
you get
me
all
otherwise.
E's? Did you get all E's?
I did.
That's all that matters. It's actually technically not, but like we're in grade 10, it's all that matters.
To us, not you don't have to get all E's, guys. It's okay.
No, to universities. No, university is not going to care your grades in grade 10. Your parents should care about your learning skills. My mom only cares about my learning skills. Yeah, for some reason, I got the same grade in PFIT as I did in gym last year. It's a very good grade, though, so I'm not complaining. It was also the same grade I got in music last year. So I do well in electives, apparently.
Look at that.
That are completely open.
Same.
That's, yeah. Like, I mean, all my marks are in the 90s, but I don't know what that noise was. But I'm really tired. Okay. You know what happened on Thursday?
What happened on Thursday?
My alarms did not go off. Okay. I set two alarms every morning, and it was 7:45, and my brother woke me up. Here's the thing. I leave the house at 8:10 because I have to walk to school. And, like, when it's snow, we have to leave earlier so that, like, because, you know, on the snow day, it took me half an hour to walk to school. Yeah. And my family knows that I get up at set. Like, I'm downstairs by 7 a.m. every single morning. So I don't know what they were doing. It took them 45 minutes to wake me up. But yeah, I was like mad, but I just screamed at the world. I didn't scream at them because they're probably distracted. I don't know.
I see.
Yeah, it was very, very stressful. It was not a good time. But I actually had like 10 minutes to spare because I got ready very, very fast.
Well, good for you then.
Yeah, someone should give me an award for that. It's called hockey.
You
and
get
also
a gold star.
Dance and theater. It's probably mostly from dance, to be honest. So, hello, everyone, and welcome to Not So Bloody Mary. The heading of this document that I'm looking at right now is the final Anne Boleyn episode. That's a complete and total lie.
A lie.
Maybe Quinn should calm herself and not do 15 pages of research for an episode.
But she did.
You know what? I did, because you needed it, everyone. Yeah, so Anne gets, this is her second last. The last one is going to go exactly from the moment she is arrested to the moment she dies. So, yeah, it's going to be a real vibe. We're recording both of them this weekend. I don't know, I'm going to say that this one will probably be out by Sunday, but if it's Monday and it's been out, don't get mad at me. I have like a life. And the other one we're recording on Sunday morning, so it should be out maybe also by Sunday night. I don't know, it depends on if, like, because I have to listen to the whole thing to see if it sounds good, like to edit it,
right?
Yeah, people, it'll be out by Wednesday, because sometimes I just can't bring myself to listen to my own voice because it makes me want to die. I'm saying I'm a lot, but that's okay. We're just gonna go for it because we've got a lot to cover. Okay, fellow nerds. Because if you're listening to this,
that's a safe word.
You are a nerd. I'm sorry. I love you, awesome nerds. That's from Pitch Perfect, and my grade 6 teacher gave us all nerds. I don't know if every country has that candy, but in Canada, we have candies that are called nerds, and they're like little tiny, like little like pebbles, and they're colored, and they're actually kind of gross, but also really good.
I've never had them before.
You've never had Nerds?
No, you know I don't like candy.
What the heck, Grace? I don't know if we can be friends anymore.
Don't
because
bully me, Quinn.
That was bully the basis me. Of my grade 6 graduation.
Quinn bullies me.
I don't. I bullied my brother. I told my French teacher in my, this is me assignment that my brother was really annoying because he sings loud and he also plays basketball and hockey in the living room when I'm trying to read.
Love that for you.
He's definitely going to get my French teacher next year, and my French teacher's going to be like, oh. Yeah. Yeah, so I was, kind of mean to Anne last time, but you know what? It was her life, so it's just going to get worse, everyone. Things were so good. Remember when we started and she was going to Europe to get a nice education?
Yep.
So nice. Now, she's in a precarious position. She has enemies on all sides, including in her own family, Norfolk. And the only person that she can be truly sure of where their loyalties lie is her baby. Because she's two. And she can't form her own opinions about those things because she learns what people tell her. So, big up Elizabeth for being the only one that Anne could be sure of when she was about to die. Yeah, we're going to start by talking about Cromwell. I hate his guts, guys. In case you haven't been paying attention to Anne Boleyn, research in the last bit, I think people kind of thought for a while there that it was Henry who wanted Anne, to get rid of Anne, and then he told Cromwell, get rid of Anne for me. It's actually that Cromwell is mad at Anne, and so he comes up with this whole thing, and then he shows it to Henry, and Henry, a sociopath maybe, who is done with Anne, and who is seeing all this evidence, you can't see my air quotes, but evidence, put in front of him, feels hurt, and he says, Cromwell, go ahead. So really, it's all Cromwell's fault, because Henry, obviously, he signed the warrant or whatever, but Cromwell is the one, she would not have died if it hadn't been for Cromwell. Well, she would have died, but she wouldn't have been executed on May 19th, 1536. A solemn day.
A very solemn day.
Yeah, it's my least favorite day in the world. No offense, Grace, because it's also our friend.
Also makes me very sad, because Quinn is crying in her room on our friendiversary.
Yeah, it's our day, and I'm sitting in my room. I literally took out my prayer book from Sunday school when I was little, last May 19th, and I prayed in my room and I cried. That's what I did. Yeah, it's sad. Also, when I need to cry about Naya Rivera, I listen to her song "Prayer for the Broken" in the dark, and I literally just sob.
I believe so it.
Bad. Yeah. Okay, so Cromwell had originally, he's a fellow reformist like Anne. He had originally been her staunch supporter, and he'd done all in his power to get Henry's first annulment to Catherine of Aragon. He also agreed with Anne and Henry that Lady Mary's precarious position was her own fault because she wouldn't sign the oath. So that's kind of on her. She's 17. She can make her own decisions. And he was also active in enforcing the king's persecution of Catherine of Aragon. He told Chapuis in 1534 that a lot of trouble would have been avoided if God had killed Catherine. Nice, you know?
Nice.
Really fun. It was actually Cromwell who relayed orders from Henry and Anne to their daughter's governess, Lady Bryan. Cromwell, his duties now encompassed very diverse responsibilities, the running of the royal nursery, and then the preliminary preparations for the wholesale dissolution of the monasteries. Very, very different things. No?
Yep.
Rita Warnick, she's Cromwell's most, this is Alison Weir's research mostly. So it's from the early 2000s, I think, this book. Lady in the Tower is what it's called. Go read it if you want to. Like, it's not a narrative story. It's just, like, research stuff. So, Alison Muir's research can sometimes be kind of dry. Yeah. Aretha Warnick is Cromwell's most recent biographer at the time that Alison wrote that book. So, Aretha convincingly demonstrated the notion of a political alliance between Anne and Cromwell has been largely overstated by modern historians because they relied too heavily on the dispatches of Chapuis and they inferred too much of them. There's not really any hard evidence to suggest that the Queen and Secretary were allied in a court faction for the purpose of furthering reform. In fact, there are actually remarkably few known instances of their ever acting together. On the contrary, the evidence shows them usually to have actually, like, operated independently of each other. They didn't usually agree on things. Mm-hmm. By the summer of 1535, they were moving, crucially, in different directions. Cromwell's attitude toward Anne had changed, probably because she resented the more radical direction in which his planned closure of the monasteries was taking him. He was pushing for their wholesale dissolution, so he wants to completely get rid of them and give the money to the crown and the crown's, like, friends. So the monasteries aren't just a place where, you know, the monks and the nuns like pray to God and hang out. They literally, like, they help the homeless. Like, if people are traveling, they need somewhere to stay, they stay there. They give out food. Like, sometimes there are schools. Like, they aren't just for like things that Cromwell thinks are negative. Like, definitely there's a lot of them that are corrupt, but Anne doesn't want to get rid of them. She favors their reform, so she wants to take the bad ones and use them for good in some ways. Perhaps Anne had also come to resent or fear Cromwell's growing power as a threat to her own influence. She was a Francophile, and his instincts, honed by his good relations with the merchants of London, were beginning to lean toward the empire, which is Spain, which is Catherine. Yeah. Basically, you know the scene in The Tudors, bringing it up again, where Cromwell comes in and he's talking to Anne about the dissolution of the monasteries, and she's like, you're getting too high-handed, Mr. Cromwell. You ought to be careful, or else I will have you cropped at the neck. And then he's like, she's like, what? Do you think I no longer possess the power to do so? I think that scene really does a good job of demonstrating that they wanted the same direction of things, but they also were going completely different directions and they kind of hated each other. They had become rivals for power. That was evident as early as June 1535, when Cromwell, who was bent on smoothing over relations with the emperor, discussed with a, like, astonished Chapuis the desirability of restoring Mary to the succession, since she was loved by the people and she would have a better chance of holding the throne than the young Elizabeth. Honestly, kind of fair, since in 1535, Mary is 19, Elizabeth is 2. She's not even 2 yet because it's June. She is 1 and, like, a half. Like, I don't know. He told Chapuis that if Anne learned of this, she would live to see my head cut off. But he remained unruffled. He said, I trust so much on my master, that's Henry, yeah, that I fancy she cannot do me any harm. Although his complacency would later turn out to be misplaced, since Henry, spoiler alert, did execute him on his and Catherine Howard's wedding day in 1540. Yeah. On February 1528, not 1528, I'm actually not reading. On February 28th, Anne felt confident enough to intercede with Henry on behalf of Joyce, the former prioress of Catesby, offering him 2,000 marks, which now is about 235,000 pounds. So that the priory could escape dissolution. Okay, that's, like, a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. However, Henry did not immediately give her a perfect answer, because the prioress had also appealed to Cromwell. Henry turned down Anne's request. R.I.P. So that was like setting things up with Cromwell. Now we're going to move into everyone's least favorite blonde. She's actually a lot of people's favorite blonde, and I don't know why. I just...
Who's your favorite blonde, Quinn?
My brother. No, it's you.
I'm just kidding. You can love your brother. It's fine. I'm not salty.
It's definitely you.
You're my Cooper's favorite brunette, annoying. Though.
Your mom and your sister listening to this. My mom like,
doesn't
what?
Really have brown hair.
She has dark hair. She's a brunette and fresh.
Sorry, Mom. Love you.
Nice. Yeah. I don't know. Cooper was being really annoyed today at dinner, so you can be my favorite blonde. Right. And my mom. But, like, I don't know. She dyes her hair, but, like, I think it's naturally blonde. It's just, like, really dark. Yeah. I don't know. I have a lot of favorite blondes. Yeah, Jane Seymour is my least favorite blonde from the months of, like, January to, like, August 1536. And then I start feeling bad for her. Before, like, between those months, I actually despise her. And before that, I'm just like, she was there. I don't care. Yeah. But by March 18th, 1536, that is 5 days before my birthday, except I wasn't born. According to Chapuis, Jane Seymour had become, quote unquote, a young lady whose influence increases daily, end quote. And her family had begun to benefit. The ambassador reported that day, the new amours of the king with the new young lady of whom I have before written still go on to the intense rage of the concubine. Okay. And the king 15 days ago put into his privy chamber the young lady's brother, Sir Edward Seymour. Chapuis praised Jane to his master as someone of great virtue and kindness whose sympathies lay with the Lady Mary. But he also sounded a note of caution, having sensed that her demure facade concealed less admirable qualities. It was to be hoped, he wrote, that no scorpion lurks under the honey. Okay, thanks, Chapuis. Honestly, that is how I feel too, buddy. Jane's brothers, Edward and Thomas Seymour, were men of ambition, who no doubt anticipated from the start that Henry's pursuit of their sister might, in the event of her becoming his mistress, lead to their own advancement. They're very not fun people. Ask Edward's dog. Oh, wait, you can't. It's dead.
You're feisty today.
Now, not Edward Seymour. Well, Edward Seymour, but Edward Tudor. Edward Tudor, his dog is dead, not Edward Seymour, because Thomas Seymour killed Edward Tudor's dog, and Thomas Seymour is Edward Tudor's uncle. That's a fun brain buster. Now, in the wake of Queen Catherine's death and Queen Anne's miscarriage, the focus of their ambition began to shift to greater things, and envisaging future glory for their sister, and power, status, and riches for themselves, they were only too eager to coach Jane in the art of virtuously snaring a king. The fact that they had pushed forward Jane as a viable alternative to Anne shows that the Seymours and others had reason to suppose that the latter's position was now able to be taken. Yeah. Sir Edward Seymour's rise to a position of influence was impressively swift. He was now a gentleman of the Privy Chamber. He was shortly to be made master of the horse, and both offices brought him into daily contact with the king, with whom he now stood in high regard, and he enjoyed increasing influence. Edward was a cold, greedy, and ruthless man, whose later nickname, the Good Duke, was largely undeserved. Given that his brother Thomas would also prove to be greedy, ruthless, and cunning, and an abuser, we might wonder if their sister shared the same character traits. Not the abuse. Not the abuse. She was cool. Among all the women Henry married, who are all major figures of that dramatic era, people really like to write about them. Jane is the only one whose personality never clearly emerges. In popular mythology, she's close to a saint. She's the perfect foil to the temptress Anne Boleyn. It's an ironic image since she did exactly what Anne is said to have done. The thing is, Jane's family also pushed her to do it. Anne's family really didn't. And also, Jane knew what she was doing. Anne was like, oh, okay. So there are two main differences between them, neither of which is to Jane's credit. The first is that Anne, unlike Catherine, was still young enough to conceive again and have another child. She had not started menopause when Henry threw her out. The second is that it became clear to Jane at some point that Anne was not to be merely discarded, but instead killed. Woot woot. Henry's determination from around like March 18th or whatever on, like end of March, to see Jane only in the presence of her relatives strongly suggests that he was indeed thinking of marriage, because that's what he did with Anne. He only saw her with her mom. And given that she might become his queen, he was determined to treat her with respect and decorum. He ceased trying to seduce her and instead took care to prevent any hint of scandal from attaching itself to her reputation. Haha, that might not work, my friend. We'll see that later. When he returned to Greenwich in March, he obliged Cromwell to vacate his chambers, and he put in there Jane's brother, Sir Edward, and his wife, Anne Stanhope, in order to bring thither the same lady. The king could access Cromwell's chambers, where Edward was now staying, from his own apartments by certain galleries without being seen. And then he could pay his addresses to Jane in the presence of her relatives, who now found themselves enjoying even greater influence with their sovereign. But the new arrangement wasn't that discreet. Chapuis knew of it by April the 1st. This arrangement perhaps suggests that an anti-Boleyn alliance between Cromwell and the Seymours was already in existence. Discovering that her rival had been installed in lodgings so near to the king's can only have aggravated Anne's enmity toward Jane and her fears.
Very true.
Now we're going to talk about the dissolution of the monasteries. Ooh. What a fun time. So Anne had fallen out with Cromwell, as we already talked about, and she was also probably furious with him for so readily giving up his rooms to the Seymours. It was not long, after all, since she had regarded him as her man. But increasingly, the main issue between them was their diverging aims in regard to the dissolution of the monasteries, which, as Vicar General, Cromwell was managing on the king's behalf. A vast survey had shown how many religious houses were redundant in terms of numbers, income, and morals, whereupon a bill for the dissolution of the monasteries had been passed in March. There isn't a doubt that monasteries had been declining rapidly in England for well over a century, but Henry's dissolution was chiefly a pretext for sweeping away any institutions that were potential hotbeds of popery, and more to the point, whose riches and resources could be used to augment the declining wealth of the king, and they could be used to buy the loyalty of those who supported the Reformation. So basically, Henry wants the money. Up to a point, Anne and Cromwell did share similar religious convictions, but Anne was now making it plain that she was fiercely opposed to the wealth of the doomed monasteries being sold off wholesale to individual men that had influence in return for their support for total royal supremacy. Instead, she, along with some other reformists, including her almoner, John Skip, she was determined that the confiscated riches should be used for educational and charitable purposes that would benefit everyone. Wow, that sounds so evil, guys. Healthcare. Education. Wow. Yeah, Anne would definitely be like a socialist. It seems, too, that the queen had openly confronted Cromwell. If Alexander Ellis is to be believed, Alexander is one of Cromwell's, like, I think he works for him. He is going to be important later. She had effectively accused Cromwell, along with the up-and-coming Thomas, I can't say his name, we've seen him before, Riothesley, the coroner and the attorney of the King's Bench, of corruption. Both of them, quote-unquote, hated the queen because she had sharply rebuked them and threatened to inform the king that under the guise of the gospel and religion, they were advancing their own interests, that they had put everything up for sale and had received bribes to confer ecclesiastical benefices upon unworthy persons, the enemies of the true doctrine. End quote. Whether they were actually guilty or not is another matter. I think they were. But Anne appears to have been completely convinced of it. Chapuis learned of the animosity between Anne and Cromwell late in March when he hosted a dinner for a bunch of people that were not Anne's friends. The fact that Anne's enemies were gathered around the table on this occasion supports the theory that they had been for some time intriguing with Chapuis to find a way to bring her down. It has been argued that Cromwell had already begun plotting Anne's fall at this point, and that his later admission to Chapuis that he himself thought up the plot on April the 18th was just a smokescreen to hide its true origins. Namely, that the king had ordered him to make a case against her, but they're far more likely to reflect his own fears as to the extent and consequences that might come if Anne hated him, of which he had only really recently been made aware. Is it really likely that Cromwell, who was a clever strategist, would have hinted at such sensitive proceedings to a foreign ambassador who might spread gossip that would forewarn the queen? She could find out if he's telling Chapuis these things and Chapuis sends the emperor, because I'm pretty sure that they probably had people that were reading Chapuis' letters. Nothing is safe. His use of the word domestic suggests the personal animosity between Anne and himself. Cromwell's fears that Anne hated him and wanted him executed appeared to be borne out on April the 2nd, which is Passion Sunday. She had John Skip, her almoner, preach a disapproving sermon in the King's Chapel on the text, "Which among you accuses me of sin?" which is John 8:46. In the presence of the king and queen, Skip mounted his pulpit and explained and defended the ancient ceremonies of the church. He made it clear that the queen's views on the dissolution of the monasteries, he stoutly defended the clergy from their defamers. Basically, he was like, y'all can't reproach these clergymen for doing things that, like, you can't say that they're all bad for some things that some people do. Honestly, a good message, because you shouldn't judge people based on their entire group. Because not everyone is the same. He insisted on the need of a king being wise just by himself and resisting evil counselors who tempted him to do bad things. And he spoke against those same evil counselors who suggested alteration in customs that had already been established. He also insisted upon the example of the biblical Persian king Xerxes, who was moved by a wicked minister to destroy the Jews. He urged that a king's counselor, quote-unquote, ought to take good heed what advice he gave in altering ancient things, and he also lamented the decay of the universities and insisted on the necessity of learning. His words left his congregation in no doubt that his references to evil counselors were aimed at Cromwell, and that there was a comparison to be drawn between Cromwell and Haman, who was the wicked minister of King Ahasuerus, which is also King Xerxes. Like, they have the same name. They are the same person. An educated court audience would also have known that Haman had also tried to bring down the king's queen, Esther, and that after she exposed his plot and thus saved the Jews from persecution, if you're a little biblical scholar, you're going to know the story of this chickie. She's pretty chill. I think I haven't read it in like 7 years, so I read it in like a comic book when I was like 5. He found himself facing death. Fun. There are at least 4 sets of tapestries that depicted this story that were hanging in the palace. The king and Cromwell were greatly angered by the serpent because it also, like, was mean about Henry. I don't know. And Skip was interrogated and censored for preaching bad doctrines and slandering the king's highness, his counselors, his lords and nobles, and his old parliament. You can also imagine that Henry was also furious with his wife because she had publicly upbraided him, basically, for seeking to replace her. Undaunted, Anne stuck to her guns. At her instigation, the reformist Hugh Latimer preached his next sermon before Henry on the parable of the tenants who refused to pay rent to the owner of a vineyard. Latimer's subtext was that once the tenants have been evicted, the vineyard would pass to more worthy persons, which is kind of what Henry's doing. The allusion to the dissolution of the monasteries was blatant, and its purpose was to persuade the king to convert them to some better use, which is what Anne was trying to do. She wasn't saying keep the bad ones. She's saying convert them to something else that would work. Okay. The next thing that happened in Anne's fun soap opera of life is that Chapuis finally recognized her as queen. Okay, so this is like Easter Sunday, I think, 1536. Or like Good Friday, I don't know. It's like Easter. When Henry and Anne entered the chapel on that service, whichever one it was, they seated themselves, as was customary, in the royal pew in the upstairs gallery that overlooked where their households worshipped. Chapuis reported, so there'd already, like, been a whole thing with, like, Anne and Chapuis. Obviously, he's never recognized her as queen before because he recognizes Catherine as queen. Even though Catherine's dead, he still doesn't recognize her as queen. They have a whole, like, there's, like, letters or something. I don't know. And Chapuis, people are now thinking, that Shipley is going to pay respects to her. So he reports that there was a great concourse of people, partly to see how the concubine and I behaved to each other when they descended to an altar to make their offerings. Anne, entering the body of the chapel from the staircase, saw Shipley standing behind the lower door. And since she came in front of him, he could not do anything other than bow to her. He wrote afterwards that she was courteous enough, for she turned back to make me a reverence like that which I made to her. So basically, he bows to her. She turned back and she did, like, bob to him or whatever. He then went further, and he actually handed her two candles to use in the altar ceremonies. And he commented afterwards on April 24th that politeness had required such a courtesy. He said, if I had seen any hope of the king's answer, I would have offered not two, but 200 candles to the she-devil. Thinking maybe that's like he wants an alliance or something. I don't know. He's being Shipley. Anne was jubilant, for Shipley had never paid her any such courtesies before. And she emerged from the chapel triumphant. At last, after all these years, Charles V's representative had recognized her as queen. That day, she could be heard loudly proclaiming, oh, my girl, watch your mouth, love, that she had abandoned her friendship with King Francis, and she was sorry that France and Spain were at war, but that she was now on the side of the emperor. It seems that the King of France, tired of life on account of his illness, which was syphilis, wants to shorten his days by going to war, is what she said. Anne, my love, France is like your friend. And you've just gotten rid of them. Like, oh my God. My girl, no. Now, it's beginning, everyone. It's beginning to look a lot like execution. On April 20th, 1536, Cromwell feigned illness and retired from court. Shipley reported on April 21st that Cromwell had taken to his bed from pure sorrow. I don't know what he's sad about. In real life, he's plotting the queen's ruin. The fall of Anne Boleyn has been seen by many as the direct result of a marital breakdown, but that is too simplistic in our interpretation, because a mere estrangement that might have occurred between Henry and Anne in the early months of 1536 cannot really explain either the suddenness or the vehemence of Henry's reaction. The evidence, therefore, strongly suggests that it was Cromwell rather than Henry who was the prime mover in the matter. Cromwell was, he told Shipley on June the 6th that, quote-unquote, owing to the displeasure and anger he had incurred upon the reply given to Shipley by the king on the third day of Easter, he had thought up and plotted the affair of the concubine in which he had taken a great deal of trouble, unquote, which would become clear. What the hell? Why is he bragging about this? You killed someone. Oh. Yeah, Shipley. I don't think Shipley thought it was really chill either. Shipley was like, what? Yeah, Shipley was actually like, he just wants Mary and Catherine, you know? Like, he hates Anne because she represents, like, the ever losing power, kind of. And also, Shipley really cares about Mary and Catherine, especially Mary. But once Anne, like, at, like, her trial, Shipley wrote that, like, she conducted herself really well. Like, he has really nothing but, like, objectively positive things to say about her once things are kind of going bad. Cromwell built his case on the king's obsessive fear of treason and Anne's flirtatious nature. By totally annihilating the Boleyn influence at court, Cromwell could preempt all risk of its resurgence and any power that it might have to bring him down. His words to Shipley are crucially significant because they prove that it was actually Cromwell's determination rather than any actual evidence that brought about Anne's fall, and that it was the master secretary who instigated that political coup that has been called one of the most audacious plots in English history. For there's absolutely nothing to support the theory that Henry passed on to Cromwell the task of finding the quickest and most effective way of getting rid of Anne. If Henry had wanted to get rid of Anne, he could have easily done so without the assistance of their enemies, because the fact remains that having perhaps toyed, he has asked about it, with the idea of annulling their marriage, he took no steps to pursue it. Is it really likely that bent on ridding himself of her in the wake of her miscarriage, and he's desperate for a son in his middle age, that he would have waited 3 months to take any action against her? If he had been working secretly to destroy her, why did he insist, almost up to the time of her arrest, on the emperor acknowledging her as queen? Because in taking such a stand, in secret expectation on her, imminent fall, on charges of immorality, Henry would have knowingly been setting himself up for a monumental loss of face because Catholic Europe would have turned around to him and said, "We told you so." Why go through such a pantomime when he could have acted on the fake evidence and he could have proceeded against her with further delay? Anne's not a foreign princess with powerful relatives as Catherine was. There's no need for him to stand up for the rights of a woman who would soon become branded a public strumpet, for he would have known that the way would soon be clear for him to marry a woman whom the whole world could acknowledge. In recent years, it's been recognized that what has been called the most rapid and bloody political crisis of the century originated with Cromwell because he had good cause to believe that Anne's influence with the king posed a threat to his policies and to his life. As David Starkey pointed out, Anne was a brutal and effective politician.
Pop off.
Pop off, girl. One might wonder why Cromwell decided to accuse Anne of sexual crimes. Probably his spies picked up court gossip, which their master seized upon and threaded together into an unseemly chronicle. Some of that gossip was perhaps based on things that Anne herself had said, because she had a habit of being indiscreet. Certainly Cromwell did make good use of the one factor that the king could understand, Anne's appeal for men and her ability to inspire passion and sexual desire. That's not anything that's her fault, right? That's just her existing. You can appeal to men without having to try. She didn't try with Henry. It just happened. So, but this could be employed to a good advantage, because it could construct a case against her that was sufficiently convincing and shocking to persuade Henry that she had betrayed him in the worst manner in his mind and made a fool of him. Possibly the ladies of Anne's household were intimidated by Cromwell to dredge up all the gossip that they could think of and tell him what he wanted to hear, which was later described at Anne's trial as bawdy and lechery. We know very few details of the initial investigations, but it seems that the initial testimony of these ladies led Cromwell to construct the criminal process against Anne. You know, when the tutors, when they're interrogating them, and they're just bawling. That scene is so sad, because it's he's so scary. He's so threatening, and he just seems really crazy. They all try to protect her, but what can they do? Definitely the people that some of the people that narked on her maybe weren't trying to protect her. But Given that there were probably fewer than 100 women among the court's population of between 8 and 1,500 persons, depending on the season, it's hardly surprising that a hothouse atmosphere prevailed when it came to the interaction between the two sexes. George Wyatt says that those that pleased the king recounted the adventures of love happening in court. The gentlemen of the king's privy chamber would flock to Anne's apartments, knowing that she appreciated witty, stimulating conversation, and that there would be opportunities to flirt with her ladies. Anne was not above joining in, as her own accounts of her banter and familiarity with the gentlemen of the king's privy chamber vividly show. Okay, the fact that she's friends with her husband's friends is not a bad thing. You should try and be friends with your partner's friends. Make things easier. My parents have a bunch of friends that they met through each other. Doesn't mean that my mother is cheating on my father with all of his friends. Not how it works. Thanks to Anne's upbringing at the French court, she was familiar and free and easy in her manner and in her social relationships, because that's kind of how the French court is. Her flirtations were innocent, because they were an accepted aspect of the game of courtly love that had been a tradition in European courts since the 12th century. The statute of treasons, however, it did not provide for a queen to be accused of high treason for adultery. Only the man who had violated her could be accused of high treason. It was not until 1542, in the wake of the fall of Catherine Howard, that the definition of treason was extended specifically to embrace adultery on the part of a queen. But in 1534, Parliament, who had been seeking to protect Anne from her enemies, had passed an act widening the definition of treason to all who, quote-unquote, do maliciously wish, will, or desire, by words or writing, or by craft imagine, unquote, the king's death or harm, and to anyone who, I don't know, threatened the king's marriage and or his issue, which is Elizabeth or any other future children. Unfortunately and perversely, this same statute was to prove Anne's downfall because committing adulterous acts was construed as treason on the account of, like, ruining the king's issue because, unfortunately, it's a worse thing if a queen commits adultery because a king can get people pregnant, but those kids, if he, like, they don't claim them, won't be passed off as princes or princesses because everyone knows who they came out of. If Anne gets pregnant by someone else and they don't, like, know that she's, you know, sleeping with someone else, then they think it's Henry's, and that kid could, like, if it's a boy, that kid grows up to be king, and there's a kid that's king that has absolutely no right to be. So, like, it makes sense, but, like, it sucks. Because Henry could have as many mistresses as he wanted and couldn't have any, lovers. But she didn't, but, like, she couldn't, and she's smart enough to know that. So, therefore, that is a capital charge. But an even worse accusation was to be leveled against her of a crime that was treason by any legal definition. According to Cromwell, who had mentioned those reports from abroad, there was a certain conspiracy of the king's death that he said left him and his colleagues quaking in their shoes. So basically they're saying she plotted Henry's death. The thought is that she plotted Henry's death with one of her lovers so that they could put their son on the throne. And yeah. Anne's every move was being observed by Cromwell's spies and informants. Fun. I think I'd actually die if people were watching my every move. But yeah, speed was of the essence because the king, who had fallen out with Anne many times, yet still remained enthralled to her, must not be allowed time for any skepticism, any sentimental feelings, or the residue of passion to overtake the shock of hearing that his wife had not only been unfaithful with several men, but had planned to kill him. That would surely, in Cromwell's mind, be sufficient enough to alienate the insecure and suspicious Henry and get rid of another possible reconciliation. The ruthlessness with which Anne was brought down is indicative of the extent to which Cromwell and others feared her and her power. What they were afraid of wasn't so much like her ability to command support from a bunch of people because she's unpopular, she doesn't really have very many friends, but they're afraid of her power that she wields over the king. Which had just been demonstrated very alarmingly when she got him to, you know, propose marriage, even though she, like, didn't really want it. Now, Henry is about to find out, our friends. So sad. I actually, like, can't. Okay, so events now move forward very, very swiftly. We have Cromwell's own account of what happened next in his letter from May 14th. Anne was not dead yet. He saw Henry on his own return to court on April 23rd, and there is no record of what passed on that occasion. It was probably then that he and other privy counselors, with great fear as the case enforced, declared what they had heard of the queen's conduct. And they told the king that we that had the examination of it quaked at the danger his grace was in and realized that, with their duty to his majesty, they could not conceal it from him. On their knees, they gave God laud and praise that he had preserved him so long from it. Henry's suspicious nature probably led him to jump to conclusions about his wife, but the things he had been told may have struck a chord. He would have been aware of the shifting factions within his court, and he knew that Cromwell had good reason to fear Anne. He knows that they hate each other. He's not dumb. Anne's probably complained about Cromwell to him many, many times. He's observant, but he also knew that he had married a woman who many believed had a sullied reputation. He himself had evidently become disillusioned about her for whatever reason, and her last miscarriage had, in his mind, been a warning that God did not smile upon their union. Now he was being confronted by evidence from members of his wife's household that she had played him false. It's really not very surprising that he wanted this investigated further. He's not saying he believes again. He's just like, can you look farther into that? That's a little weird. I mean, I probably would say that too, Henry. I hate you, but, like, they've got fake evidence. The very next day, April the 24th, at Westminster, the Lord Chancellor, Sir Thomas Audley, a man who was very much under the influence of Cromwell, appointed two special commissions, a legal procedure for hearing and judging pleas of the Crown that had been in use since the 13th century. Their function was to determine, like, if there is a case against Anne, and if there is one, whether it should proceed. These commissions were very rare, and they were only instituted in very serious cases. There were actually only 17 of those in Henry's reign. That in itself, together with the specifying of the counties in which the Queen's alleged offenses were said to have been committed, shows that this commission was actually specifically appointed to examine the evidence against her. In most cases of oye and termine, which is what this is called, a commission was only issued after the accused had been arrested. In this case, it was issued beforehand, probably to avoid the usual delay of about 11 days, which suggests that Cromwell, fearing that the king might succumb again to his great folly over Anne and dispute the evidence, was aware of the need to secure a speedy conviction. So the Middlesex Commission was addressed to Lord Chancellor Audley and others, the Kent one to the Duke of Norfolk and others. Audley's name appears only on the former, but both commissions consisted of Cromwell himself, Anne's uncle, the Duke of Norfolk, the Duke of Suffolk, that's my gramps, thanks, Charles, Anne's own father, Thomas Boleyn, Earl of Wiltshire, John de Vere, Earl of Oxford, Ralph Neville, Earl of Westmoreland, Robert Radcliffe, Earl of Sussex. Hey, that's Harry and Meghan's thing. I mean, not anymore, but like, it was. Wait, is it still? I'm so confused. I don't know what's happening. Anyways, William, Lord Sandys, Sir William Fitzwilliam, my fave, Sir William Paulet, Sir John Fitzjames, Sir John Baldwin, Sir Richard Lister, Sir John Port, Sir John Spelman, Sir Walter Luke, Sir Anthony Fitzherbert, Sir Thomas Englefield, and Sir William Shelley. The jurors of Middlesex comprised of 8 esquires entitled to bear arms and 40 gentlemen, while those of Kent were 3 soldiers, 6 esquires, and 16 gentlemen. All were described as discreet and sufficient persons. Can you imagine being called up for jury duty and it's for the Queen? Hey, so this is your, like, your constitutional duty or whatever. You gotta do jury duty. Queen. It's for Queen Anne to see if she committed adultery. No one could say that these men were not competent to examine the evidence against Anne because they included among their number the, like, top lords and the chief judges of the land. Unfortunately, all of them prospered under Henry, and they enjoyed his favor, or they needed to prove their loyalty, and therefore none of them was likely to risk his status and his prosperity by, saying that she wasn't guilty, which would make Henry mad. That's what they thought, anyways. The jurors, so that's like the normal people, were no doubt in some awe of the nobles and the lords on the commission, and were therefore anxious to take their cue from them. Nearly every petty juror, I don't know what that is, maybe that's like the lords, I'm not like in law, was a servant of the crown, a creature of Cromwell, and no friend to Anne. Meanwhile, Anne had her daughter with her at Greenwich. so sad. Elizabeth was at Greenwich when Anne got arrested at Greenwich. No! Among the final entries in Anne's household accounts relating to April 28th were payments for silver and gold fringe and gold and silver buttons for a saddle for the king. Henry, she's buying you presents and you are getting her arrested. Something doesn't add up. 2 leading reins with great buttons and long tassels for Princess Elizabeth. And the very, very last entry ever in Anne's household accounts is a cap of taffeta with a caul of damask gold. I don't know if that's like for her or for Elizabeth. I don't know. But she's buying, that was her last thing she ordered. Probably never got it. Hi, it's Amazon. Are you okay? We haven't heard of you in a while. We haven't heard from you in a while. You want to rate us? You know when they send you that thing, it's like, can you rate your transaction? She got that in the tower and she was like, no, I don't want to rate my transaction. Anne's wits were sharpened by worry and fear, as like you tend to do. Everything seems bigger when you're scared. She had already somehow sensed or learned that something was afoot. With our household being closely interrogated, how could she have failed to suspect something was going on? That Anne already feared something ill might befall her and realized that Elizabeth would soon be left in a very vulnerable position is clear from her seeking out on or soon after, Wednesday, April 26th, her chaplain of 2 years, Matthew Parker. We talked about this in our Elizabeth episode, but Anne charged Parker with the care of Elizabeth if anything happened to her. She didn't share with him what she feared, but it's likely that in the event she was afraid that in the event of her marriage being annulled, she might be forbidden to see her child or Elizabeth might be bastardized. She didn't have really any idea of what actually would befall her. On April 27th, letters summoning Parliament and a letter commanding the Archbishop of Canterbury from his palace at Knowle were issued, paving the way for any legal process against the Queen to be formally endorsed. Outwardly, though, life was going on as normal. The King was still planning to take the Queen with him to Calais on May the 4th, departing for Dover, immediately after the jousts planned for May Day. By April 29th, as preparations for the visit were going ahead, the Privy Council had formally, they already knew, they've all been on her jury or whatever, they had formally been informed of the planned judicial proceedings against the Queen, and rumors of her imminent disgrace began circulating at court. Cromwell now constructed what was almost certainly a convincing case against the Queen, in which she was to be charged with adultery with five men. One, her own brother, another, a lowly musician, and conspiring regicide. Why does that sound like a movie description? The five men who over the next few days would be arrested for committing treason with the Queen were George Boleyn, Viscount Rochford, that's his little title, Sir Henry Norris, Sir Francis Weston, Sir William Brereton, and Mark Smeaton. Notice how he doesn't have a sir in front of his name. Or a title, because he's a musician. He is a no one. Sorry, Mark. I'm kind of mad at you. Of all the men who were accused with Anne, Smeaton was the only one to persist in his admission of guilt, which proved to some appalled contemporaries that he was no gentleman. If Cromwell contrived this plot against the Queen, and on his own admission, he did, why did he select these particular men to be her partners in crime? Certainly, he chose them for shock value. Just one accomplice would have been enough to make a charge of adultery stick, but Cromwell wanted Anne's reputation irreparably ruined. And for this and other reasons, he chose to accuse her of criminal intercourse with five lovers. Rochford was Anne's brother, and incest was probably as great a taboo then as it is now, although it was not illegal in his times. I don't know. And it didn't become a misdemeanor until 1908 when the Incest Act was passed. I'm going to assume that's a British thing because Alice Muir is British.
Not cool.
But don't do incest, guys. It's not cool. Nevertheless, Agnes Strickland, writing before then, called it a crime of the most revolting nature, which was probably how most people viewed it in the 16th century, because they are right. It is gross. Norris, Brereton, and Weston were longstanding friends of the king, so to betray him with them rendered Anne's infidelity all the more heinous. Smeaton was of humble birth. That the Queen of England could have brought herself to stoop so low to satisfy her lust only served further to blacken her reputation. He picked pretty good people to do it. What is surprising is that no woman was arrested for aiding and abetting the Queen in her alleged crimes. When Catherine Howard was accused of adultery in 1541, Lady Rochford was arrested for acting as a go-between and lost her head for it. As the Catherine Howard affair proved, it would have been impossible for Anne to conduct all these affairs with men from the court without the help of at least one very trusted female attendant. Perhaps significantly, however, none of them were targeted or arrested, which might in itself prove that the case against her was
true.
A little not the greatest. On April 30th, Cromwell and his colleagues laid before the king further evidence of the queen's immorality, alleging that she had seduced several members of the privy chamber, her own brother, and Mark Smeaton. The investigators assured the king that the affair was beyond doubt, that they had seen the queen dancing with a gentleman of the king's chamber, that they could produce witnesses who would vouch to the queen having kissed her own brother, and that they had in their possession letters in which she informed him that she was pregnant. Okay. You can
literally
dance with men,
oh my God,
without sleeping with them.
Anne is a dancer.
Also, Anne likes to dance. She's just dancing. I don't know.
She's a dancer.
I'm a dancer.
Anne and dance moms.
Anne should be on Dance Moms. Yeah.
Oh my god.
She could be the mom in Elizabeth Carrying the Child. Elizabeth also danced. Yeah. Dance Moms producers. Yeah. You should make a whole nother show just with them. Also, you can kiss your siblings. Like, it doesn't say, like, she, like, but it was, like, made out with him.
Actually,
she, like, kissed him. I kissed my brother.
Actually kissed them. Wasn't it, like... Like, when we were watching the Tudors, I was like, oh my god, are they making out?
He kissed her on the forehead. He kissed her on the forehead. In the Tudors. I'm sure that he probably just, like, kissed her on the cheek, and they were like, oh my gosh. And Madge was like, sometimes the queen kisses her brother. They were like, yep, write that down, write that down, write that down. Like, I don't know. I kiss my brother on the cheek when I say goodnight. Some people do kiss their siblings on the lips. Like,
ew.
They don't, like, use tongue. They just kiss. People kiss their, like, I don't know. It's not weird to, like, just, like, peck your sibling. Also, it's 1536. I'm assuming that, like, things were completely different then. But, like, they wrote letters very like they were true. In love with everyone they were writing to. So, I'm pretty sure that you can just, like, chill. Also, what you're talking about where with Anne and George and the Tudors, I'm sorry, but it actually made me uncomfortable because Natalie and whoever the heck played
literally,
George had,
oh
like,
my God.
Chemistry in, like, a really weird way.
It was really weird.
I felt like they were always meant to make out. Like, it's probably just because, like, we're not really used to seeing, like, siblings
true.
That are adults on a television screen. Like, we have, like,
they
Ross and
like
Monica,
children.
But, like, they, like, just punch each other. Like, yeah, but, like, Anne and George were acting like children, to be honest. I think it's just because they're, like, really close. And so we're just so used to, like, only seeing that with, like, two adults that are both, like, that are of different genders on a television that it just seemed like they were about to always be making out. But they did have very odd chemistry that made me very uncomfortable. Like, I don't think it was the direction that they were supposed to be always about to make out. I think it's just that Natalie and this guy had chemistry in an odd way. Obviously, she had, like, way more with Jonathan, but, like, I don't know. It just...
Yeah.
It was weird sometimes. Also, the whole letter where Anne tells her brother that she's pregnant thing.
Like, no.
Obviously, she'd tell her brother she was pregnant. No, she's gonna hide it from him. Also, they're, like, best friends. She has, like, no friends, and he is one of, like, the three that she has. She's obviously
she's
gonna
like,
tell
bestie.
Him that she's pregnant, even if he wasn't her brother. Bestie, guess what? Bestie. But the whole thing is, like, they say that she she told George she was pregnant because it was his kid. No, she's like
oh
hey,
God.
George, you're gonna be an uncle.
Wow.
Hey, George. Yeah. Yeah. Alexander Aless was there. He made it clear that it was at or just after that meeting on April 30th that it was decided and concluded that the queen was an adulteress and deserved to be burnt alive. Fun. That same day, an angry and outraged Henry okayed the arrest of Mark Smeaton, and he summoned the council to urgently debate the evidence against Anne and her other alleged accomplices. After this, Anne's accusers moved against her with such speed that suggests that they were unsure of their case, they were fearful of her influence over the king, and they were above all determined to bring her down. Sometime that day, or the next morning, Aless witnessed the king and queen arguing. He wrote an account of what he had seen in 1559 in a letter to Elizabeth I. It says, quote unquote, "Never shall I forget the sorrow I felt when I saw the most serene queen, your most religious mother, carrying you, still a little baby, in her arms, and entreating the most serene king, your father, in Greenwich Palace, from the open window of which he was looking into the courtyard when she brought you to him. I did not perfectly understand what had been going on, but the faces and gestures of the speakers plainly showed the king was angry, although he could conceal his anger wonderfully well." Unquote. The cause of the quarrel is not known because Les could not hear the words that passed between the royal couple. It's possible that Anne was fearful that Henry would get to hear of her conversation with Henry Norris, which is the one where basically Henry Norris is at Anne's chambers with all of her ladies. They're all chilling. They're having a good time. They're having a party. And Anne starts bugging him. She's teasing him because Henry Norris is like kind of courting Madge, but like not, like they're not very, She's like, Mr. Norris, you need to make a move. Why are you always hanging around here with Madge, but like not doing anything? And he's like, ma'am, I want it. And she's like, you know why you do it? And he's like, why, ma'am? And she's like, because you look for dead man's shoes. If the king were dead, you would wish to marry me. In her mind, she was probably just flirting, like courtly flirting. And then she went, oh, shoot. That went too far. So she like immediately like gets Norris to like go swear to like a priest that nothing happened. And she goes and she like confesses that she did. Like, oh my God. She like freaked out. She's like, oh crap. What did I do? But yeah, it's possible that Anne was fearful that Henry heard of that. And she sought to preempt his anger by trying to explain herself. And she took Elizabeth with her for the maximum emotional appeal. Or that Henry had already heard about it and that she was trying to diffuse his wrath. It's recently been suggested that Anne was pleading with him for mercy, and she may have also done that. The council sat until 11 o'clock that night. When the meeting broke up, an announcement was made that the planned trip of the couple to Calais would be postponed for a week. No reason for that sudden change of plan was given. Then, Mark Smeaton was arrested. The fact that he was initially questioned for at least 24 hours suggests that Smeaton did not willingly divulge any information. Yet in the end, whether he was tortured or not, he finally admitted that he had been three times with the concubine in the spring of 1535, a confession that was at variance with Anne's own independent recollections of her dealings with him, in which he said that she had only spoken to him twice, and then only briefly. So he's like, yeah, we banged three times. And she's like, yeah, I spoke to him two times, and like we said like five words to each other. I don't know who he is. So, like, why did Mark Smeaton confess? So he was perhaps told, as Norris would be, that he could save his life by confessing, or he could have been informed that since it was already known that he committed treason and he was going to die anyways, that he might be rewarded with a quicker death. Because Smeaton is not a gentleman, he is a commoner, so he gets the hung, drawn, and quartered option. But they're like, maybe they said, if you give us information, then we'll just let you die. Like all the gentlemen, this choice was like later offered to Anne. And this would also explain why Smeaton was allowed to die like a gentleman. Smeaton not only confirmed the allegations of Anne's ladies, but he told much more. Cromwell now had the information he needed to proceed against Anne, and so he quickly went to go lay it before the king. At the May Day tournament at Greenwich, Anne was disconcerted when Henry got up and just like left without a word to her, but she really didn't have any idea that she would never see him again. Lancelot de Carles, what a name, says that during the jousts, Henry loaned Norris his own horse, and that he shown kindness to Norris, Weston, and Brereton, but it is unlikely the king had been made before the tournament of the results of Smeaton's interrogation, which further criminalized the three of them. Henry's abrupt departure was prompted by a message that he was given, which was almost certainly to inform him that Mark had confessed to adultery with the queen and had incriminated George, Henry Norris, Brereton, and perhaps Weston as well, which confirmed what the king and his ministers already suspected. Immediately after the tourney, when the jousts were over and they were all like disarming, archers were ordered to arrest Norris and were much astonished and grieved, considering his virtue and intimacy with the king, that he should have committed disloyalty. The captain of the guard came and called Master Norris and Master Brereton and said to them, "Sirs, the king calls you." At dawn the next morning, Norris was taken under guard to the tower. On entering his prison, he was permitted to see his chaplain, and he told him that he had never betrayed the king, reiterating, as he had already said, "I would rather die 1,000 deaths than be guilty of such a falsehood."
That could be arranged.
Okay. Yeah, you can do it. Around the same time, Mark Smeaton was also committed to the tower. George Constantine Anthony, what? I don't know if that's like a typo, but I'm gonna assume not. His name is Anthony because names are weird then. And the Spanish Chronicle all give the date of Mark's arrest as May the 1st. Constantine says that Mark was brought to the tower in the morning, and Anthony claims he was taken there at 6 p.m. Anthony was the surveyor of the ordnance at the tower and should have been in a position to know when Smeaton arrived, but it seems that he was mistaken because Chapuis, who's pretty reliable, wrote on May the 2nd that Smeaton had been taken to the tower early that morning, and Lord Rochford followed after dinner, which was served at court between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m., and more than 6 hours after the others. This was later to be corroborated by Anne herself when she referred to the fact that accommodation was not found for Smeaton in the tower until 10 o'clock on the evening of May the 2nd. Rutherford's, like, George's arrest was so discreetly accomplished that few people knew he had gone. Anne didn't know he had gone. She's still at Grunge, just, like, chilling, thinking George is, I don't know, at his apartments with Jane, and he's, like, in the tower. No one knew what was going to happen next. Even Chapuis didn't have any inkling of what was to happen next. And everyone's been arrested, and no one has any idea what's to come. Anne is just chilling in her little palace with her little baby daughter, and Henry's somewhere else pissed at them. Yeah. That's where we're leaving you, because I'm a fun person. Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. She's going to get arrested, like, tomorrow. Today. Same day, I think. Yeah. So, like,
we like hey, when people, you listen and enjoy what y'all. We do.
Y'all are like...
That's so cool.
We have, like, 7 different countries that listen now. Thank you for listening to us, because we are, I don't know, boring, but thanks for listening. Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know. Go follow us on our Instagram, notsobloodymary_podcast. I've been a lot more active recently because I don't have anything to do, so sometimes I just go on there and randomly post things. honestly, go follow this famous TikToker. Her name is Grace. I don't know if you know her. Her at is at @thelovely_bookworm. It's book content. You guys are nerds. Maybe you'll like it. I don't know. I haven't read like any of the books because I'm like an old lady. But she has 10,000 followers now, so you guys should go follow totally. Her because she's pretty famous. I think you have more followers on TikTok than Carter has on Instagram.
It's so hard to get followers but on like, Instagram. It's TikTok, way hard you to just get like see a Instagram good video and you're like, oh so. Yeah.
I mean, I don't do that. I have like a really bad public following, but like, yeah, that is what most people do. I actually can't, like, it makes me really uncomfortable to follow people. I don't know why. I'm like, but do I want to actually see you all the time? I don't know. You're a bit weird.
I know.
Anyways, not you. Your videos, like, never pop up anymore.
Oh, my God. Like,
all these Diana Agron that I follow post so much. They're so funny. I love them. Oh, also, wow. Amy Atkinson posts, like, 5 videos a day. She's absolutely addicted, everyone. Go follow her on TikTok. Yeah, I get to see her tomorrow, guys. It's our last dance class tomorrow, guys. I'm actually going to have an anxiety attack and a meltdown. And then immediately go, like, buy something that's going to bankrupt me. Yeah. But then I have Millie's dance class on Sunday, and we're going to vibe. I had to do the beginner jazz because I don't trust myself to, like, do intermediate. Let's be fair. I don't trust her to properly market it because she's, like, actually really good. So she probably thinks the intermediate is, like, really good. I did dance for, like, 10 years. I've been dancing for over 10 years. Yeah. But, like, do I trust myself? No. Literally on the, this is completely off topic, everyone, but on the Thespi, like, Thespi Thursdays chat, like, yesterday, with Amy and Millie, she said that she still has routines from when she was 7 memorized, and she can just do them. What? Yeah, I can't do that. I barely even remember what songs I did. Yeah,
Everyone, be kind to someone.
Go spread some joy.
We do.
Because we need it. We really do, because life is depressing. If any of our, there was a whole bunch of our American listeners that were from Texas. So if you guys are in Texas, yes, please be safe. Yeah. And We really hope that you're okay. We live in Canada, so, like,
yeah, we get, like, a lot worse. We live in our igloos. We're all
prepared
set.
Prepared for them. So, my cousin's, I don't know, my cousin's friend asked me if I lived in an igloo when we were 10 and I was in New York City. Yeah, don't ask people that. But anyways, if you, you know, if you're in Texas, and I'm really sorry, guys, mm-hmm. and I really hope that things get better, because it's really crazy right now. Yeah. Woohoo! Yeah, I think that, y'all rock, and I think that, you're pretty chill, and also, everyone, go, cry about Anne Boleyn.
Go make...
Don't actually do that, because I don't want to endorse you crying.
In memory yeah. of her. Just hot, a hot beverage.
Or a hot chocolate, or, like, just hot water, I don't know, you're weird. My mom drinks hot water because she doesn't like coffee. Go have a coffee unless it's like 9 at night.
Will you?
Yeah. Okay. Friends and gentle people. I'm gonna really need to talk to my therapist about this episode, but I hope you enjoyed it. It just was very mentally taxing to research. And I'm sure the next one will be even worse. Love you all. Have a good night, day, evening, morning thing.
COVID friendly.
Woohoo. Here's a kiss on your forehead. Yeah. I stole that from Recovering Gleek. Sorry, Lena, but it makes me happy. So
bye.
I did it myself. Yeah. Bye, everyone. So long. Farewell.
Good night.
You have to finish it because you actually sound nice.
I had the best part.
Oh, ready?
Gretel's Unite.
You sang that. Gretel's Unite. Gretel's Unite. Yeah. High school. My brother's school did that. And I actually wanted to, like, yeet myself away because it was not very good. Sorry to whoever was Gretel. I honestly don't remember. You sounded actually really good. I think you were the best one. They didn't do Sound of Music. They did this weird musical mashup thing, and it hurt me. It hurt something deep within me. But you know what? What do you expect from elementary school theater? I don't know.
Bye.
Yeah. Bye, people. Go spread some joy.